books or ideas. What you consume influences who you become. On the Mind and Matter podcast, we learn together from the best scientists and thinkers alive today about how your mind-body reacts to what you feed it. Before starting Mind and Matter, I spent 10 years in academia doing scientific research. I got a PhD in neuroscience, where I focused on neuroendocrinology and the neurobiology of behavior. And before that, I specialized in molecular, developmental, and evolutionary genetics. I use my scientific background to help parse and translate the information that guests share on the podcast. In addition to the podcast, I write long-form written content inspired by the show, where I integrate what I've learned across episodes. I also have a free weekly newsletter where I provide you with upcoming guests, share links, and provide commentary on scientific studies and research that I'm reading, and more. Visit mindandmatter.substack.com to find all of my content. This episode is ad-free, and I rely on my audience to support my efforts. If you're getting value from this content, please consider becoming a paid subscriber to the Mind and Matter Substack. For just $5 a month, you'll get early access to episodes and other content, full episode transcripts, and I'll prioritize answering your questions in emails and the comments sections. You can also support me by checking out the links in the episode description to my affiliate partners, who make various health and wellness products that I use and enjoy myself. You'll receive a discount and help support the podcast that way. And if you want the benefits of a paid subscription, but it's not in your budget, simply sign up for my free weekly newsletter, send me an email, and I'll give you a complimentary paid subscription. Word of mouth is the best way to help the podcast grow. So if you like what I'm doing, please share your favorite episodes with family and friends. The purpose of the podcast is to provide you with information obtained largely from primary sources, the people doing the research and producing new knowledge. This content is never meant to serve as medical advice. And with that, enjoy the episode.
I'm calling in from just north of Copenhagen, Denmark. So I'm both a professor here at University of Copenhagen and also at the University of Cambridge in Britain. Mm. So the day after tomorrow, I'll head off to Cambridge.
Ah, and are you Danish originally?
I'm Danish, yes, exactly. So by birth, yes.
Can you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what you do as a scientist?
Yeah. So I'm an evolutionary biologist, and my primary tool is what we call ancient DNA, right? So it's genetic information from the past, and we're both retrieving such information from human teeth, from animals, but also from entire ecosystems by retrieving it directly, DNA directly from ancient soil. So we are, you can say, using this tool to address quite diverse questions, everything from, human spread across the world, changes in lifestyle with humans, to the extinction of the last big-bodied megafauna, the big-bodied mammals in the end of the last ice age, to how ecosystems are changing. And right now, actually, my focus is to try to take some of these changes from the past, adaptive changes, and then see if we can get them into present-day crops to make them more resilient towards climate change, for example. So we also look at pathogens, human pathogens. So it's very diverse, you can say, what we are doing, but the toolkit is, for most parts, this ancient DNA.
In terms of looking at ancient human DNA, in one sense, you're looking at things that are very old. You're looking at, humans that were around thousands, tens of thousands of years ago. In another sense, you're looking at actually recent human evolution, because it's a much more a recent picture of how humans changed just in the last few thousand years compared to, say, someone who's studying like Neanderthals or humans from millions of years ago. So when you're studying humans that are our ancestors thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago, what's special about that time period, and how do you actually obtain this DNA?
Yeah, well, a lot is happening within the last 10,000 years of, you can say, human history, human evolution, right? It's the period where we are undergoing the changes in different parts of the world, from being hunter-gathering which we have been, you know, since we emerged as a species around 600,000 years ago, into new lifestyles. So in terms of lifestyle, there's not that much, you can say, it seems that is changing until around 10,000 years ago, and then everything changes. And so therefore, it's a very, you know, this more recent, if you can say, the more recent part of human history and human evolution is actually very interesting. We are getting the DNA from all kinds of ancient skeletons. So it's really, you can say, it's from collections that has in some cases existed, you know, for more than 100 years in various museums. Sometimes we are also participating in excavations ourselves. I mean, so basically getting material fresh out of the ground. And there's really two types of materials from humans we are particularly interested in. One is teeth, because teeth has in general a pretty good preservation of DNA, but they also, we have learned, they also contain DNA from the bloodborne viruses and DNA viruses and bacteria that these humans were carrying at the time of death.
So you can get a picture of not just the human DNA, but the pathogens that they were interacting with.
That's exactly right. And the other piece is what is known as the petrous bone, which is basically fused to the inner side of your skull. It's part of the inner ear. And that's the most dense bone in the human body. And therefore, it's particularly well preserved, the DNA there. But opposite the teeth, you are normally not getting, there's not much of blood flow in the petrous, so you're normally not getting the pathogens. So the beauty about the teeth is if you can get DNA out of the teeth, you're both getting the human as well as the pathogen that human were carrying at the time of death.
And when you recover DNA, is this typically nuclear DNA of the full genome? Is this mitochondrial DNA? Is it both?
It's both. we are, been saying for many years now, my team actually did the first ancient human genome back in 2010. And that was, you can say, a major achievement at the time. But, you know, due to the sequencing technology and, you know, drop in prices of sequencing, etc., I mean, we are basically shotgun sequencing all materials we're getting, right, from humans. So depending on the DNA preservation, you can get either, you know, what we will call a low coverage human genome. It means not every position is covered once, but still, you know, it's kind of covered across the genome. And in some cases, you will get like a fairly high coverage human genome if the DNA, endogenous DNA allows for it. And at the same time, when you are doing the shotgun sequencing, you are also getting the mitochondria. Because the mitochondria is present in many, many more copies per cell than any fragment of a nuclear genome, right? So you will typically get a very high coverage of the mitochondria. And then obviously you will get anything else which are in there. It can be soil bacteria, viruses, fungi that have penetrated the tooth after death, but also the human pathogens that has been deposited through the blood flow has been deposited in the cementum of the teeth. So you're getting all that by shotgun sequencing, and this is what we do. If you are then are particularly interested in a certain region where you want a higher coverage, you can then additionally do what is known as a targeted capture, where you go in and try to pull out, you know, as many copies as you can of this particular piece of DNA you're interested in.
Before we get into some of the interesting findings that you have uncovered over the years, I want to talk about the quality of the data and how we know that we're actually looking at the DNA that was present in these people. So when you recover samples, you know, you've got a copy of the genome in every cell. And then, as you said, you've got many copies of every mitochondrial genome inside of every single cell. So, you know, when we think about the preservation of DNA and how much it degrades over time, are you able to just sort of like figure out what the real genome sequence was because you've got multiple copies in every cell and every mitochondrion?
Yes. So, until we got what is known as this next generation sequencing, where you do the shotgun sequencing, the biggest problem for any ancient DNA work, but particularly ancient human DNA work, was contamination with modern DNA, right? Because the DNA in any ancient specimen is highly degraded. It's fragmented into short pieces. Very often is the majority of the DNA maybe in the range of 30 to 50 base pairs long. So very short pieces, and there's also very little of it. And therefore, in the old days, you know, where you used kind of traditional PCR, then the shortest fragment of DNA you could amplify and still, you can say, have some information of value would be around 90 to 100 base pairs. And because the vast majority of the DNA is actually, of the ancient DNA, of the endogenous DNA, is shorter than that, right? It became a numbers game. I mean, if you had very, very little DNA that was that length or longer, then very often it would be swapped by contaminant DNA, right? And there was no way to really distinguish the two. But with next generation sequencing, you can target these very short pieces of DNA. And there's this, you can say, if you imagine there's this reverse relationship, exponential relationship between fragment length, right? The length of the fragments and copy numbers, you know, number of copies of endogenous DNA. So as soon as you went very short, suddenly the amount of endogenous DNA just increased enormously, right? Contamination just by that exercise became way less of a problem. But then secondly, you know, it's clear because you preserve with shotgun sequencing, you're preserving the termini of the read, of the DNA read. So it means this is the place where it's particularly attacked by DNA damage, you know, deamination of cytosine. So you can see that DNA damage. So you can actually see which one is a damaged ancient fragment versus what is most likely a contaminant. And then finally, because next generation sequencing allowed you to produce this enormous amount of data, I mean, full genomes, right? Then you also have a statistical power to ask, for example, let's say you have a male, right? I mean, how many Y chromosomes do I have? You should only have one, right? Is there something additional, and you can quantify then the amount of contamination that additional is, and you can basically take it into account in your downstream analysis. So in shortly, I mean, contamination that was this huge, huge problem for decades is really becoming, you can say, a minor problem today in the field.
And so it sounds like an early part of the research process for your team is literally stitching together genomes. So the genome is fragmented, and you have to piece it together like a puzzle almost.
Yes. So we do this by using a reference genome, right? So we use them, you can say, a modern human genome. And then you basically take all your small pieces and see where do they stick, right? And what is quite surprising is when you have something down to, let's say, 50 base pair fragments, it's in the range of, I think, 70% or 80% of the human genome that where you can uniquely map these very short fragments. So even if they're short, you can uniquely map them. I mean, the kind of the cutoff is around 30 base pairs. When you go below 30 base pairs, you know, there's multiple places they can stick in the genome, right? So normally the cutoff for what we can work with is around 30 base pairs. So this is what you do. And then more recently, you know, we and some of our collaborators has used very successfully what is known as imputation. I mean, so if you imagine you have kind of this, you can say, genome of an ancient human, but there's a number of holes in it. There's a number of places where you don't have information. And you can actually, based on knowledge about populations and the frequency of different bases in the genome, you can actually predict with very high security what are these missing bases. So it means you are almost at a stage where almost where an ancient human genome is as good, if you want, of quality as that of a modern living, modern human being.
Mm. Okay, so you have almost as much confidence in the genome sequence from people living thousands of years ago as you would if you sequenced my DNA today, basically.
Yes, yes.
And so I want to talk to you about fairly recent human evolution, but I want to give people a sense for what we're talking about, for when certain things happen. So I want to start to build a picture for people right now, help them triangulate certain things in their mind. Mm-hmm. So all of us have a common ancestor that came out of Africa. Yes. When did human beings first emerge out of Africa? Homo sapiens emerge out of Africa. And were those human beings what we would consider anatomically modern human beings? And what does that even mean to you as an evolutionary biologist? What is a modern human being?
Yeah, no, this is good questions. So, I mean, it's generally believed, right, that you can say the lineage leading to modern humans and the lineage leading to modern day chimps, which is our closest present day relative, right? This is, they are diversifying from each other. It means they start evolving in two different directions, sometimes around 6 million, maybe a little older, a million years ago, right? And and this is happening, believed to have happened in Africa. And mm-hmm. and the evidence behind this is mainly, you can say, of traditional fossil character. You'll find basically, you can say, early types of humans, which are not anatomically modern human, not our species, but you can say things that are believed to be on the human lineage, right? And along the way, you know, a number of different hominin types, human types, if you want, early human types are emerging, right? I mean, we have Australopithecines, we both have gracile and robust forms. So one should imagine a world where there's more than one, you can say, type of human in the landscape, right? So you, even in Africa, you actually, it seems to be that you can have, different types of hominins If you looked at them, you would probably recognize, well, it's some kind of human-like creature, but if they met each other, they would be quite distinct from each other, right? And so this process kind of continues, and it's not different from what you see in other mammals, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's, you see different types popping off, right? Some survives, some are replacing others, etc. So, we along that route, you can say, we also see very massive increases in brain size, right? There's still debate whether this increase is something that happens very rapidly, because that's how it looks in the fossil record, right? You're going from one group with a very small brain to suddenly one which has a larger brain. But that could also just be a result of the fossil record itself, right? You don't have everything from the fossil record. So there's still discussion, you know, how fast does this happen? But it happens. And there's a couple of instances where you in the fossil record see kind of a doubling of the brain size, right? And we also learn along the way to have some kind of tool use, right? And the first of these hominins that seems to have left Africa, as far as we know, is what is known as Homo erectus, right? So it's as far as I recall, it's around, you know, a million to half a million years ago, something like that. But they are the first ones kind of getting out of Africa. And also the first ones that we know of that are, you can say, having fire, for example, right? Mm. They have a substantial smaller brain than we had. We have, but very thick eyebrows, etc. But you see them both within Africa and in Southeast Asia. Then you can say the second group that seems to be leaving Africa, as far as we know, seems to be Neanderthals, right? Which is, you can say, a group of hominins that has actually been genome sequenced It's the only, I would say, only hominin that has really been genome sequenced beside modern humans, and that certainly have a capability of producing tools, etc. And then you can say, then in terms of our own species, Homo sapiens, the anatomically modern human, well, based on morphology, this is based on morphology. You find skulls, if you want, that looks like modern humans, sometimes around 600,000 years ago in Africa.
In Africa,
exactly. And, you know, we are then leaving Africa. There's a lot of debate whether there has been attempts, early attempts to leave. You know, maybe you have, you know, samples, for example, from Israel, you know, which are dating around 120,000 years ago. But these, in any event, it doesn't seem like these early attempts, if they have been there to leave Africa, have given rise to non-Africans today. So it looks like the migration that kind of gave rise to all non-Africans, as far as we can see, is a migration out of Africa happening sometimes between 90,000 and 60,000 years ago.
Okay, so 90 to 60,000 years ago is when we think humans left Africa. The humans that gave rise to all non-Africans left Africa. There may have been attempts of anatomically modern humans to leave before then. There probably were. Maybe they just didn't spread very far. Maybe they just died out. But you're talking over 500,000 years ago, you've got anatomically modern humans, and a little under 100,000 years ago, they leave Africa and eventually give rise to all non-Africans.
Yes, that's right.
Exactly. When that group left Africa 60 to 90,000 years ago, our ancestors were talking about, what was the earth? Where did they go first? And what was going on geologically and ecologically? Was that during an ice age? What was happening?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so, it seems like there's still debate from where they came out of Africa. Was it out of North Africa or was it actually further to the south? But exactly what are they doing out there, and why, how can it be that they're first so successful quite late? I mean, think about it, right? Modern humans presumably originates around 600,000. I mean, it's a long time, right, that they have stayed in Africa.
Hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been different, I mean, nobody knows for sure, right? But some of the assumptions has been that Neanderthals that had left Africa at that point, you can say, kind of occupied the regions outside Africa and made it difficult for modern humans to really establish themselves outside Africa. And, you know, at the time when modern humans then successfully leave and give rise to present-day humans outside Africa, it's a time where the Neanderthals are already in massive decline. I mean, so that's one interpretation.
And also, I would imagine if we're coming out of Africa, I would imagine that much of Africa for much of this time was habitable and fertile and had plenty of food. So maybe there was not a lot of need to leave.
Yeah, it's a good question, and this is kind of the traditional, I guess, view of how to look at a modern human, anatomically modern human. Well, we are kind of a sort of an animal that are basically going for resources. We're staying in the same place until the resources are depleted, and then we move on, right? But I would say some of our more recent studies, for example, of peopling of the Americas, I think is really challenging that view. Because this is also basically Stone Age people. It's a group of hunter-gatherers, right, coming into the Americas and entering a completely uninhabited continent. And, to our great surprise, I mean, as soon as they have bypassed the so-called Pleistocene ice caps that at that time were covering most of Canada, and they get south of the ice caps, I mean, within 1,000 years, right, they are all over North and South America. They have crossed the Rockies. They have, you know, they have adapted to everything, you know, from desert to tropical regions, etc. So it's not, it's very hard to see that the behavior is a result of, you can say, depleted resources.
Yeah, they're not just staying somewhere until everything's gone and leaving. They're, they're moving the whole time.
They just move, explore. Mm-hmm. And to me, at least, it suggests that at least early anatomical modern humans are not that different from us, right? Why do people climb, you know, Mount Everest, right? There's no reason for it in terms of resources, right? They do it because they're curious. They want to understand. This is what is typical of our species, right? Is we are exploring, right? Mm. And we adapt.
Yeah. We have the physical and physiological capability to move long distances, to go into different climates. And then we also have the mental proclivity to want to just see what's over there.
Exactly. And, you know, you see people, we can also see from the early modern humans that left Africa, right? I mean, what happens to them? Well, the first one we know of, which still have descendants today, that are kind of taking off, if you want, from the rest, are kind of saying, well, we want to explore the world, you know, we want to see what's out there. That's as far as we can see, that's the ancestors of Aborigine Australians and Highland Papuans. Mm. So they kind of say bye-bye to the rest. It's already something like 70, 80,000 years ago, where you can say our ancestors, European and Asian ancestors, kind of stay put. They stay in the same region.
Stay put where? Would that be like in the present-day Middle East, roughly
speaking?
Yeah.
It's a good question. Nobody knows for sure, but the assumption is it's somewhere
roughly in that area.
In that area, right?
Okay. So so you got a population that leaves Africa, it gets to roughly that general region.
Yes.
Part of that branches off and presumably follows the coast to Australia.
That's the assumption. You know, they follow certainly Southeast Asia. That's the idea. And they make this incredible journey, right? Which is remarkable, really. I mean, they're crossing Asia, and they're crossing from mainland Asia into Papua and Australia, which at this time are connected together, but still isolated from the mainland, right? So they're basically crossing the ocean already around 60,000 years ago.
On boats, presumably.
Presumably by boats, and they do it, you can say, with a sufficient population that they can establish themselves. And they keep going basically until the present day, right? So this is a remarkable journey. And then you can say Asian and European ancestors at this time, that doesn't exist Asians, that doesn't exist Europeans, neither, not genetically, they're not separated from each other. But around 50,000 years ago, you see that there's different groups taking off, right? So one group becomes, if you want, present-day Europeans. Another group become present-day Asians. And then there's a third group that we actually didn't know about until we did ancient genomics. You know, it's a group that just after the Asians and Europeans are splitting from each other around 50,000 years, on the European side, are basically branching off. And this group is occupying most of North and Central Asia, as far as we can see. And this is the group that becomes one of the main groups that are ancestral to Native Americans. But it dies out, you can say it dies out in Asia later on. So we were not aware of it. I mean, we basically, you know, everybody thought Native Americans is a group of Asians, right? But in fact, what we can see is that Native Americans is the meeting between two different populations, an Asian population that are meeting these very ancient group of people that are living from mammoth hunting and hunting of woolly rhinoceros, etc.
Okay, so by 600,000 years ago, anatomically modern humans have evolved in Africa.
Yes.
By about 90,000 years ago, they have left Africa somewhere in roughly the Middle Eastern region, roughly speaking. By about 70, 80,000 years ago, so shortly after that, some of those people branch off and they become the Australian Aborigines of today. So they travel to the east and down that way. So 60, 70,000 years ago, that's happening. And there's no white people in Europe. There's no Asian people as we think of them today. That hasn't emerged yet.
No, exactly. And so then you see this kind of emergence, as I said, 50,000 years ago, you start seeing the emergence of what becomes the Asians and Europeans. But I mean, what probably many people don't realize is that, you know, Europeans and Asians have not, I mean, today we think about Europeans are in Europe, Asians are in Asia, right? That's how we look at it. And but when you go back in time, it has not always remained like that, you know. So there's been plenty of periods where, you know, large part of Asia was actually occupied of genetically speaking European populations, and also periods where Asians are moving. For example, you know, they are in North Asia and then they're moving into Southeast Asia, kind of mixing up with, you can say, the some of the people who were left behind when people crossed into Australia. It's not like everybody went to Australia, right?
There was
along the way. So it's, you can say, the world that we know of today, I mean, the world that you and I and everybody else learn in school and see, you know, Asians in Asia, Europeans in Europe, you know, this is a very, very young world. It's for the, you can say, the whole genetic composition of present-day Europeans, you can say the main characteristics, if you want, is formed within the just the last 5,000 years. And when we go to Western and Central Asia, we are only back in the medieval times. I mean, right? So it's around 1,000 years ago. So it's one of the things that ancient genomics really have. I think there's two things that it has really changed our minds with compared to what we generally thought before. One is that people are super mobile, right? I mean, there was this notion that when we left Africa, we went to the different parts of Europe, different parts of Asia, etc., and then we kind of stayed put, you know, wherever we went, right? And when we had a cultural change, it was always because the same people learned to do something new, right? So when you went from hunter-gatherer to agriculture in Europe, it was because you learned to do something new, right? But it was the same people who basically stayed. And ancient genomics have very clearly shown this is not the case. I mean, people have been super mobile, and many of these, you can say, historical transitions or prehistoric transitions from hunter-gathering to farming, from farming to Bronze Age, from Bronze Age to Iron Age, from Iron Age to Viking period and so forth, is actually a result of migration of people. I mean, new people entering an area, meeting somebody else, mixing up with them, right? Transferring different types of knowledge with them. So the world, you could, as I said, the world that we observe today is very, very young. I mean, for most parts.
So 50, 60,000 years ago, I think you said, that's when the populations that gave rise to present-day Europeans and present-day East Asians first started diverging. So at that time, 50, 60,000 years ago, everyone still had like dark skin.
Yeah, yeah. As far as we know, yes.
And were they all still like hunter-gatherers at that time? And
yes.
How long does it take from then to get to the first farming societies?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first farming, there's still debate about exactly when you see it, right? But, you know, something around 12,000 years ago is where you see the early attempts. And it's happening in the Middle East and Near East, right? Where you both domesticate plants and animals. And then there seems to be an independent domestication event, if you want, of rice, happening in the Yangtze region in China. And you also see close to the same time period, maybe slightly later, you see the domestication of corn in America, right? So you have these kind of three domestication events in the world that, as far as we know, have not much to do with each other. It happens kind of independently, more or less independently, but very closely around the same time.
I see. So farming probably didn't develop one place and then spread through cultural transmission from there. It probably was independently discovered in different times and places.
Exactly. And for many years before ancient genetics, the general notion was that, yes, it was developed in these different places, but it spread as culture. Right? It was not by humans. It was spreading by culture. You know, I heard from my neighbor that heard from his neighbor, from his neighbor, all the way down to the Middle East. Well, you can do this, right? So I learned in school, Eske, you derive from the Stone Age man in Denmark, direct lineage up to today. And for both, where we have really done some investigation on this is for Europe and it's for Asia. And in both cases, this story is wrong. So it's very clear that the domestication practices are being spread by humans moving. So it's humans moving from the Middle and Near East up through Europe, particularly Western Europe. And it's peoples from the Yangtze region in China moving south, right, into Southeast Asia, bringing with them rice. And in both cases, you can say it result in some places by a mixture of the two populations. I mean, the hunter-gatherers and you can say the farmers, right? And in some regions, we can also see that it actually resulted in a replacement. I mean, it means one group is basically killing off or replacing another group. So in Denmark, for example, where you have the most skeletons from this transition period, I think anywhere in the world, really, there everybody first thought, well, okay, it's just, you know, farmers entering Denmark in the end and then mixing with the Danes. But more recently, we could see when we sequenced a lot of these, this is not the case. What happens is they're coming at mixed from the south, right? So you can say there was happy days in the south where hunters met farmers, they mixed, got children, changed to become agriculturalists. And then when these guys move further north, and when they move further north and get into northern Germany and Denmark at least, then they replace all the original hunter-gatherers within 1 to 2 generations, right? So it, to me at least, we don't know exactly how it happened. We don't find any pathogens. So it looks to me like it's some kind of genocide, to be honest. So it varies from region to region exactly what happened, but it's very clear it's this kind of movement of people bringing with them new technology, right?
When people in the Middle Eastern region that eventually become the Europeans start to move into the geographic region of Europe as we define it today, when did that start to happen, and how much of it had to do with receding glaciers or the ice age or climate change?
Well, I mean, at that time, you can say when this is happening, it's starting around 10,000 years ago. You know, and at that time, you are well into what we call the Holocene, the warming period we're living in today. So the glaciers have disappeared, right? I mean, it's you can say it's a non-glaciated landscape that they're moving into. So it hasn't really much to do with the glaciers. I mean, the glaciers play a role earlier in terms of, you can say, the survival of the hunter-gatherers in there, you know, and some seems to be surviving in some refugia, you know, where there's less harsh. And then when the ice retreats, you know, they're expanding out and so forth. But the lifestyle remains the same, right? It's and as far as we can see, you know, it's kind of the same peoples, if you want. It's maybe one pocket that are surviving and expanding out, but overall it's the same. Where you can say the real changes are happening, as I said, is from around 10,000 years ago, right? Because first you have the agriculturalists coming, and they have a severe impact, right? I mean, you are going from a diet which has been mainly, you know, meat, fish, berries, roots, right? What you would call a Stone Age diet today. Some people want to even living like this today, believe it's healthy. But these agriculturalists Basically coming with a diet that is similar to muesli, right? To present day muesli. So very rich in carbohydrates, right? And you can see the implication of this lifestyle change is massive. So it's both in terms of course the dietary, it's in terms of, you know, you go from being very mobile, right? The hunter-gatherers are super mobile. They're living in very small groups, right? Suddenly you become stationary, you live in larger groups. And we see, you know, massive selection of the so-called fats region.
Fatty acid metabolism genes.
Yes, exactly. So when you eat fish and meat, you're getting long-chain fatty acids directly from the diet, right? And you need that for your brain and for your nervous system, etc. But when you eat grain, you get it as short-chain fatty acids, and the body needs to basically make it into long-chain fatty acids. And the fats region is involved in this. And we see massive selection. That means it's a matter of survival and reproduction, right? Whether you are capable of doing this. So,
meaning you're seeing selection for the spread of genes that can handle shorter chain fatty acids that you find in a more carb-rich diet.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Right. So you see. So it really changes, you can say, the genetic makeup really of the peoples in Europe, right? In order to adapt to this new lifestyle. And then, you know, in Europe, you can say, then we have, it's quite interesting because in Western Europe, this is where you see this movement going up, right? But there is actually a climb going from the Baltic countries all the way down to the Black Sea, where for whatever reason, we don't know why, but you see that the hunter-gatherers on the east side of the climb is actually genetically different from those on the west side. And for some reason, you know, these farmers from the Middle East are only really entering on the west side. So the west side gets, you know, so the climb between east and west gets further deepened, right? Because the farmers are only going in and mixing with the groups on the west side. Maybe it's something to do with, you know, culture. They are more hostile. We don't know. But it's very clear. It's not a physical. It's not a geographical barrier. I mean, there's nothing, you know, that should kind of separate the two, but it does. And that barrier actually first dissolves in the Bronze Age around 5,000 years ago. So around 5,000 years ago, you have the last major migration into Europe. So now, you know, we are farmers in the West, and on the East side, they still remain hunter-gatherers.
So there's like this invisible barrier between them. There's not like a giant mountain there separating them, but something, maybe language, maybe culture is preventing them from mixing. And then you said there's a last major migration into Europe.
Yes.
Who's migrating? Who is this migrating?
Yes. So this last migration, major migration, is from the Pontic Steppe. And the Pontic Steppe is the area which is Ukraine today, is part of Belarus and Russia. And there's a people there that are, you can say, pastoralists. They are drinking milk. They have, you know, big herds of cattle, sheep, and so forth. We call this group Yamnaya. And they are expanding, this is also something that you didn't know before ancient genomics. But 5,000 years ago, we see an expansion from this Pontic Steppe, both northwest into Europe and eastwards into Asia. And they have an enormous cultural and genetic impact in Europe, particularly in northwestern Europe. So they're coming in. They are very tall.
I was about to ask is their stature different? Is their bone structure different?
Yeah. Oh, totally, totally. Yeah. I mean, So the hunter-gatherers were quite tall, many of them, and they were actually, this is interesting, they were quite healthy. I mean, when you look at them, they're quite healthy. The farmers are very short, small generally, short in stature, and actually surprisingly unhealthy. I mean, their teeth are in very bad shape. You know, they have worn down.
I've heard about this before. Is that probably because the farming lifestyle, the things that they started eating, were driving that unhealth?
Yeah, probably. Probably was part of it, at least. And it's kind of, you know, it's interesting to think about, right? Because farming obviously is the lifestyle that wins the battle, right? And it actually wins not only 10,000 years ago in Europe, but all across the globe, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody are eating pizza and drinking Coke, which is just an advanced form of muesli, right? And so farming is winning as a lifestyle. And it's a bit surprising when you look at the hunter-gatherers and the farmers, right? Because the hunter-gatherers are super healthy looking. The skeletons, the farmers look really poor, right? But evolution, it just reminds us really that evolution is not about, you know,
the physically strongest per se.
It's about who's getting most kids, right?
Yes.
That's really what it's all about, right? So you can have a pretty horrible life as long as you get enough kids that survive. Mm-hmm. And I guess the conclusion is, well, for some reason, the farmers are simply getting more kids that survives, and they're winning this battle. But it means that the, you can say, the Europeans after the farmers have entered are actually much smaller in stature. I mean, they got a lot of farming gear.
Do you think that was purely driven by diet and lifestyle? So like, were the pastoralists bigger because they drink milk, or were there genetic differences?
There's clearly genetic differences. And we can see that the Yamnaya, the Bronze Age people, these tall people getting in, very light-skinned, right? They also have brown eyes. The people they are meeting, they are in Europe, the dominant eye color is blue or gray. These guys have brown eyes, they're tall, they have light skin. And we can see genetically, we know this, right? We can see that some of, you can say, these genetic traits that are giving you increased probability of becoming tall are coming in with the Yamnaya. Mm. And it makes good sense, right? Because Yamnaya, where they really, you can say, have a major genetic contribution in Europe, the largest genetic contribution is in Northern Europe and Northwestern Europe. And generally, Northwestern Europeans are some of the really tall ones, right, in Europe. Of course, you can say diet determines whether you can express your full potential, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so if you get a shit diet, I mean, you can have all these genes, but you will not get as tall as you could have been, mm-hmm. right?
But that potential is set based on the lineage.
The potential is set. And another thing, they're bringing several things with them, right? They're bringing, you know, this height, the light skin, the blue, the brown eyes. They're also bringing with them the ability to digest milk sugar as adults.
Yes, right? I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. So if you look across the world today, I mean, obviously all babies can drink milk, basically digest milk sugar. But for the vast majority of the world's population, you lose this ability when you become an adult, right? When you grow up. And you can actually become kind of ill, sick, if you drink untreated milk. In Europe, Northern Europe, Northwestern Europe, around 80% of the adult population can actually digest milk sugar, right? And this is a trait that seems to come in with Yamnaya.
So they first evolved it, presumably because they domesticated animals that could be used to for dairy.
Exactly.
So if that was happening, we're talking like what? You said like 10,000 years ago or less. How quickly did that spread? It must have been very, very quick, which would imply a very strong advantage.
Yeah, it's interesting because it actually first seems to become high frequent in Europe much later. So it's getting into Europe around 5,000, something along those lines. And But it's first in really in the Iron Age, it seems to reach high frequencies. So it's thousands of years later, right? We don't know exactly why, but maybe there has been some kind of famine, right? Mm. Where you can say if people slaughter the cow, right, they have maybe one month of meal. If they milk it instead and drink it, you know, they can survive longer. We don't know. But so it's one of these things where it's enter, but it actually takes quite some time before it becomes really high frequent as it is.
I see. So for a while, there was a few people who could tolerate milk and dairy as adults, but it didn't really spread much. And for whatever reason, it wasn't for thousands of years before it became much more frequent in certain parts of Europe, at least.
Exactly. And now, today, obviously, it is in Northwestern Europe very frequent. Hmm. So, yeah.
Interesting. So what other you mentioned that there's been selection for changes in genes involved in lipid metabolism, how we deal with different types of fatty acids. You've mentioned the lactase persistence thing, the ability to digest milk as an adult. That has spread in just a few thousand years quite far. Not obviously there's a lot of people who are lactose intolerant even today from various parts of the world. So it hasn't spread completely. Were there other major like metabolic shifts that were happening around this time? And do we think these things are sort of independent or do they all kind of tie together?
No, it's very interesting. I mean, we did a study on this published something on this earlier this year. So, you know, basically, if you look at all Europeans, right, today, I mean, you can say every European today is really... you can say a result of the meeting of these three migration events, right? The hunter-gatherers, the farmers, and the Bronze Age Yamnaya, right? That's what make up Europe, Europeans. So all Europeans can be modeled, as we call it.
By some combination of those three ancestors.
Exactly. And what distinguish Europeans from each other, Northern Europeans from Southern Europeans, Eastern from Western, and so forth, is how much of each of the three ancestries they carry, right? Mm. So Southern Europeans carry relatively more of the farmer ancestry, right? Eastern Europeans carry relatively more of the hunter-gatherer ancestry. And Northwestern Europeans carry relatively more of the Yamnaya Bronze Age ancestry.
When you say Northwest Europe, what countries today would that
include? Well, that would be, Scandinavia, right? The Netherlands, Germany, places like that. Mm-hmm. Right? And what is really interesting is, you know, there's something called UK Biobank, which is really a huge database with all the information that people know about in terms of genotype-phenotype relationship. It means, you know, what mutations, if you want, or variants, genetic variants, are giving you a higher probability of getting tall, for example, or, you know, getting diabetes or getting multiple sclerosis or all kinds of stuff, right? Eye color, whatever. And now when you have, you can say, the genomes of the original populations, right? The three populations, the hunter-gatherers, the farmers, and the Yamnaya. Then you can actually take their genomes and paint UK Biobank, right? And say, well, is there certain traits that arrived with each of these three migrations, right? And therefore has a higher or should have a higher frequency in the different parts of Europe, right? And there you can see that, as I said, this about being tall, Northwestern Europe coming in with Yamnaya, right? Alzheimer's, for example, is a trait where the genetic variants giving an increased risk of Alzheimer's seems to be coming in with the hunter-gatherers, right? Hmm. So it should have a higher frequency in Eastern Europe. Anxiety, is a trait that seems genetically come with the farmers, right? Should have a mm-hmm. higher frequency in Southern Europe. And then a thing like multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disease with a very high frequency in Northern Europe, right? Not least Scandinavia, and it's remained a mystery. I mean, how can it be that you see this huge frequency, high frequency in Scandinavia, particularly, and of course in parts of the U.S. where Scandinavians settled back in the day, and there we can see those genetic variants are coming in with Jamnaya, but quite surprisingly, they have been positively selected for, right? I mean, today you look at multiple sclerosis and you kind of think, okay, you know, what's the benefit here, right? And it's been positively selected for. And we can see it originates in Jamnaya. It's been positively selected for around 5,000 years ago when Jamnaya emerged, or shortly before that. And then it's getting positively selected for again when they enter Europe, right?
Hmm.
And there had been some speculations that maybe these genetic variants that are giving increased risk of multiple sclerosis also are giving people increased protection against pathogens, bacteria and virus infections.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we look at, you know, thousands of samples of the viruses and bacteria, very interestingly, we can see that the zoonotic pathogens, those that are jumping from animals to humans, right, the ones that we are fighting today, basically, and also in historical times, they seem to really emerge in the pontic steppe area.
Mm.
And they get to a huge explosion around 5,000 years ago.
I see. So I guess the idea here basically is people were domesticating animals. We were living in close proximity to those animals. We started to get diseases from those animals. And then selection favored people with genes, yes, to do with how our immune systems functioned. They were presumably genes that made our immune systems better at handling those zoonotic pathogens, but also left us vulnerable to things like autoimmunity.
Exactly, because then the interpretation here is, of course, that, well, you know, to have such an overactive immune system is a benefit when you are, you know, when you're exposed to all these pathogens, right? But then, of course, in modern times where, you know, we erased a lot of these pathogens, right? Then you are standing back with an overactive immune system that then starts attacking you, right? Because of hydrogen, right? Extreme hydrogen. But back in the day when you had all these pathogens around, it has been a benefit, and it's kind of noteworthy, I think, that if there hadn't been people like that, right, that had these variants, you and I probably wouldn't have been here today.
Hmm.
So you can say we should actually be grateful for the people who are carrying it today, and of course are struggling with it. But they are really the reason why the rest of us has a place in this world today.
Hmm. You know, we mentioned some of those metabolic adaptations before. So depending on whether you're talking about having an ancestry that involves more of the hunter-gatherers versus more of the Neolithic farmers versus more of the pastoralists from the other regions, these people had different lifestyles. They had different types of food that they started to adapt to. So when you think about things like carbohydrates and different fatty acids and dairy and stuff, and you think about some of the prevalence of metabolic disease today and how it differs across different populations, how do you start to think about present-day metabolic disease? Are certain people more susceptible to things like diabetes because they have a certain ancestry that's mismatched to the diet that they're eating today?
Yes. I think that's exactly right. And you can say, because farming and the farming lifestyle is the lifestyle that kind of got distributed across the world, right? Then you can say, depending on when your ancestors underwent this change in lifestyle, actually influence, you can say, the chance of you getting ill, right? Because, I mean, if you see when I've been visiting and worked together with Aboriginal Australians, for example, I mean, there, when you go to some of the communities in Australia, I mean, we're talking up to two thirds of the village has diabetes type 2, right? And going into dialysis and stuff. And these guys, the ancestors of these guys were exposed to this farming lifestyle maybe, you know, 100, 150 years ago, right? So there's obviously been no time, no chance of any genetic adaptations, right?
Yeah, and they don't have the physiology that can handle a high grain based diet.
Exactly, this enormous amount of carbohydrate. And I think I even read some papers where, you know, that some of these people that are suffering from diabetes type 2, if they then, you know, change the diet into bush food and, you know, then in some cases, you know, the diabetes stops, right? So while in Europe, obviously, I mean, there we have had thousands of years, right? We are not to adapt. We are not fully adapted. I mean, it's a very short time span. We have been farmers or having a farmer diet compared to the time span we have been hunter-gatherers, right? I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of years we have done hunter-gathering. But we are partly adapted, right? We are more adapted, if you want, to this type of lifestyle. So it really, you can say, your ancestry in that regard actually influence, you know, your health state, if you want, or your chance, if you want, of being healthy or unhealthy, given that the type of food you are eating today is an advanced form of farming, right?
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say, in some sense, all of us everywhere, in terms of our metabolism, in terms of our physiology, we are all hunter-gatherers, because for most of human evolution, that's what people always were. Exactly. And then certain people from certain lineages have partial adaptations to a more agriculture-based lifestyle, but probably not what we would call complete adaptations, because farming is so new, even for the people who are descended from farmers.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So a lot of our modern metabolic problems have to do with the fact that farming adaptation is incomplete, and it's only in certain lineages. Some people don't come from those lineages at all.
No, exactly. So you see it also, right? I mean, many of the groups around the world that has these huge elevated risks of diabetes type 2 are very often, you know, people that were undergoing this transition very late in history, right? I mm-hmm. mean, also see it also among some Native American groups, for example. And so, I mean, people, we used to learn in school that the farming, the agricultural revolution was the revolution that created civilization and all the good things in life, you know, we are blessed with today, right? But another way to look at it, I would say, is that the transition from hunter-gathering to farming also created a lot of the problems we have today. I mean, both in terms, of course, of lifestyle diseases, as we just discussed, but also in terms of the pathogen pressures, right? You know, we see infectious diseases all the time, also in the hunter-gatherers, but we don't see any evidence of these huge kind of epidemics. They are first emerging, you know, when you see this change in lifestyle, right? So a lot of, you can say, the bad things that people have suffering from historically as well as today are really a result of the farming lifestyle. And people could also say that the enormous population increase we have seen, you know, in the world is ultimately also a result mm-hmm. of farming lifestyle.
So on the topic of genes related to nervous system function and behavior. So mm-hmm. we talked about Europeans, all Europeans as being comprised of some combination of these pastoralists mm-hmm. who were tall and sturdy people who could eat dairy and had domesticated animals. The hunter-gatherers, that were leading a traditional hunter-gatherer lifestyle, and then the Neolithic farmers, who were some of the earliest farmers. So all Europeans today are some sort of genetic combination of those three groups, and the exact balance differs from, you know, based on your personal ancestry. Mm-hmm. In terms of another way that those groups differ beyond diet is social structure, population density, the way they would have interacted with each other. I would imagine that each of those groups, right, you're living with a different number of people. The culture is structured differently based on, you know, farming versus hunting and gathering versus raising animals out on the grasslands. Is there any evidence that the nervous systems followed different evolutionary paths, that maybe certain personality types or certain disorders were more or less common in these different groups?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't know. We actually don't know, I would say. I mean, what we can see where we get some glimpse of some of this stuff. For example, if you look at the genetic variants that today in Europeans and North Europeans give a higher risk of schizophrenia, for example. There we see higher frequencies in the Viking period than what we see today. And what to make out of that is very hard. You know, it's, you know, if you are kind of, I guess the first thing when we saw it that struck me was you talk about these berserkers in the Viking period, right? That maybe that was the ones or whatever, but we don't really know. And we have a very, I wouldn't say we have any good grip of how, you know, this is working out. I mean, one thing which I think is striking is that when you look at early anatomically modern humans, our species, and you take, there's a few, it's quite rare, but sometimes we find, you know, skeletons that are, you know, 30,000, close to 30,000 years old, where you find multiple individuals, right, from the same site. So we did some years back one called Sungir in Russia, which is one of these around 30,000 years. They have all kinds of, you know, cultural ornaments and all kinds of stuff. And people, when traditional physical anthropologists had looked at these bones, they kind of said, well, it's a typical evidence of inbreeding, right? It's a small population. They can't find mates. They're breeding with each other and are inbred. And one of them had an amulet of a human bone, and they said, well, this is a Neanderthal they killed, you know, it's an amulet, and the humans that are lying head to head are close family members and so forth. And when we did the genetic testing, all of this was wrong, right? So it turned out that they are not closely related. Yes, they're coming from a very small population size, effective population size, they're a very small group of peoples, but they're not inbred. And they're not closely related family members. And by the way, their so-called Neanderthal bone actually turned out to be one of the person's ancestors that they were carrying and not a Neanderthal. And what is interesting about this, when you talk about the behavior, to go back to the behavior, is what it tells us is that these early hunter-gatherers, beside being living in small groups, maybe, you know, max 20 people, right? Less, very often less than that. They still avoid inbreeding. So they still have, you can say, a behavior where they're going out finding mates, mm-hmm. right? New mates.
There's probably some kind of cultural taboo that they had.
Exactly. There's some kind of cultural taboo, right? But if you look at the Neanderthal genomes that has been sequenced so far, which are all late Neanderthals, right? They are incredibly inbred. They're totally inbred.
Which I guess would mean either they never developed those kinds of cultural norms, or those late Neanderthals had no other choice.
Exactly. So that's exactly the question, right? Why are they remaining inbred? Is it because they had no other choice? But it could also be, and this is speculation from my end, but nevertheless, it could be that it's one of the key behavioral differences between Neanderthals and modern humans, because you can say in terms of survival, if you are relatively, if you are have a reasonable population size, right? Then in terms of survival, I mean, if you just mate randomly, whoever you meet, mate with, you know, your family member, you mate with somebody you meet, you mate with everybody, right? I mean, if you are a reasonable amount of people on the landscape, well, you will survive, right? Because some of those children will be okay, right? Some of them that won't be very good because of inbreeding depression, but as when you become very few people on the landscape, right? Then, of course, having this strategy of how to go out and get mates becomes incredibly important. And even historically from modern human hunter-gatherer societies, I mean, from America, from Australia and other places, you see these strategies to avoid inbreeding, right? I mean, if you think about the Plains tribes, for example, right? They were also living in relatively small family groups, right? Most of the year. And then once a year, they are meeting these huge gatherings, right? Where they are exchanging wives and mates, right? And then they are spreading out again. And so maybe it is a behavioral difference. And now I'm again speculating, but if you look at these early modern humans, I mean, they have very strong cultural expressions, right? They have beads, all kinds of ornaments saying we are us, you are somebody else, right? While to the best of my knowledge, this has never been found with Neanderthals, right? Mm. I mean, you never find this kind of expression that kind of tells you who are we relative to another group, right? So it might be one of the key differences between the two.
Another thing that I thought was, so I want to go back to something we mentioned earlier. So you mentioned earlier that when you looked at the skeletons of Neolithic farmers as compared to, say, the pastoralists, the skeletons were less impressive. They were more sickly looking, less robust. But we also mentioned that evolution is about how many ancestors you leave or how many children you leave behind, not about how literally big and strong you are. If you can have a lot of babies without being big and strong and robust, you're going to have a lot of babies, and that's all evolution really cares about. Do we know anything about whether farming created, say, large food surpluses that just enabled people to have more children? Were they having more children? Do we know that for sure?
I mean, that we don't know that for sure, but that's the assumption, right? The assumption is that you can say farming give you a more stable food source, right? That you are less prone, you know, to kind of fluctuations, right? I mean, of course, even for farming, there's good years and bad years, but the idea is that you would have less of them, right? You have a more stable food source. Whether this is the only reason or the reason, it's hard to say. I mean, one of the things we're trying to figure out, I can't come with a definite answer yet, but we are also trying to understand whether you can say, could it be that the farmers were just more fertile? Right? I mean, that they, genetically speaking, got more kids, I mean, than the farmers, right? Than the hunter-gatherers. We don't know. And it's one of the things that would be very interesting to understand, you know. But the general kind of assumption is, you know, it's the stability of the food production. But there's a lot of these basic assumptions where I think we have learned over the years that we have to be very careful. Because, I mean, if you take, we just talked earlier about the pathogens, for example, right? And you rightfully said, well, the idea is, well, we domesticated animals, and because we were living close to the animals, this is why, you know, the pathogens start jumping from animals to humans, right? And that has been the general notion for many years. But when we actually look at the data, right, what we can see is that we first really see this evidence of this happening around 6,500 years ago. And farming started, you know, well, 10,000, 12,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's clear that I'm not saying that they never jumped a pathogen from an animal to a human before 6,500 years ago, but what I'm saying is it didn't become common, right?
Yeah.
Until
yeah.
6,500 years ago.
Yeah. Because and therefore, yeah, it wasn't common enough that you needed very strong selective sweeping.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and it's only 5,000 years ago where we see this massive explosion, right, in the punching steppe of these types of pathogens. So in other words, the explanation seems not to be as simple as simply, okay, we have domesticated some animals, right? Now they are jumping.
Then something else changed in addition to that.
Exactly, right? So there's something in the lifestyle, if you can say, of the steppe people, of these Bronze Age steppe people.
Perhaps they domesticated different animals, new types of animals, who knows?
Well, I mean, it should be kind of the same, right? But maybe they lived with the animals in a different way.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Maybe they were, you know, sleeping on top of them or next to them or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it was the sure number. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe the numbers, the herds was just much greater. But it's just an example of one of these things where you can say there has been an explanation for, I mean, decades, right, that everybody puts into, because it's kind of logic, right? It's logic, right?
Yep.
It's the same with the staple food source, right? Everybody buys into it and say, okay, well, this is probably how it was. But then when we actually start getting some of the evidence, you know, the story is not just as simple as what we kind of assumed. And therefore, I'm a bit hesitant to say, with the farmers, you know, well, this was the reason, right? It was because they got stable food sources. Yes, it might be, but there might have been other things at play here as well.
Another thing that's interesting that I think you've seen some interesting patterns with is when I think about Neolithic farmers, for example, I think about, okay, farming means food surplus, means more people. So you've got people living in proximity to more animals. And that with that comes the possibility of intestinal parasites, other infections, more people, which means another route for infections because higher population density means easier transmission. But also more people means more potential mating opportunities and with that sexually transmitted disease. And you've seen some interesting patterns in your data. What have you noticed there when it comes to intestinal parasites and diseases and STDs?
Yeah. I mean, it was a huge, I mean, generally, the general notion was that real, you can say, epidemics in terms of, you can say, real pathogenic epidemics first occurred, you know, around the medieval times, right? That was the general notion, that you had the Black Death and, you know, that pestis infections, you know, and it was... It was really based on one written records, and then the assumption that you needed fairly, as you said yourself, fairly dense populations, right, for pathogens to spread in an epidemic manner. And then basically by chance, that's when we discovered, you know, that the teeth are carrying, you know, these infectious diseases, right? We could see that during the Bronze Age, right, 5,000 years ago, you had a massive plague epidemic, right? I mean, we had 10%, around 10% of all the skeletons we looked at were infected by pestis, right, with the bacteria that creates plague. So you can say it seemed, and now we even have evidence of plagues happening earlier than that, right, with the farmers. With the farmers, there's also coming some plague epidemics. So you can say the whole story of disease and spread of disease has been important way earlier than what we thought, and has probably been a major driver of many of these migrations that we see, you know, happening. Back.
You mean people probably did a lot of moving to get away from disease and things like
that. To get away, right? And also you had almost entire populations dying out locally, right? Either fleeing or they're dying out, new land becomes available, you know, other people are getting into this, and this becomes this, you can say, particularly during the Bronze Age and after the Bronze Age becomes this huge melting pot, right? Where people are moving, you know, east, west, south, north, and creating, you can say, a world where, as I said in the beginning, you know, that the world we are a product of today genetically is very young, right? I mean, is something that was established very, very late in our history. So I think these, I mean, in terms of you can say, the role of pathogens and diseases has been much more pronounced, if you want, earlier, even in prehistory, than what we previously thought.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you don't need to live in a city of millions of people for pathogens to spread easily. It's much smaller than that. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be you don't it, and also the way they spread, right? I mean, the general notion at the time was that the earliest type of plague was the plague that was spreading, you know, from by fleas, right? Biting fleas that bite humans. And what we could see is that the earliest form of plague and pestis is really the one that is spreading through saliva and blood directly from human to human, right? And mm-hmm. or from animal to human. And then, but there's no flea. And then we can see in around the mid-Bronze Age, right? Some 3,000 years ago, that's when the bacteria get the mutation that allows it to survive in the flea gut, right? So it blocks the gut of the flea becomes more and more hungry, and then it's biting and spreading. So a lot of, you can say, the assumptions we had about these diseases completely changed. We could also see, you know, a thing like hepatitis B, right, which is a sexual transmitted disease today. There's hundreds of thousands, I believe, dying from it, millions being infected every year. You know, when we started this kind of work, there was people who believed hepatitis B have only been present in Europe for the last 500 years, right? When we then started looking in the old ancient skeletons, we find it almost 5,000 years back in time, right? So, and when you then take these strains and you look, you know, at how do they resemble present-day strains, it completely changes our conception of mutation rates, right? So all the mutation rates about these pathogens that people were working with was based on modern strains, right? But the modern strains only is a tiny, tiny subset of all the strains that has been in the past. If you add those, right, the whole mutation rate changes. And it's really fascinating because it gives you really a roadmap in terms of what part of a pathogen, of a given pathogen, what is a super variable region, right? What is very conservative regions that could be target for vaccine development? It gives you, you can say, it gives you actually a very strong indication of how these pathogens will mutate in the future, right? Because when you get the genomes, you know, these were the ones that back in the day, this combination of mutations was successful, right? This was a successful pathogen. And if it's and therefore it becomes only a matter of time, when will these mutations reappear, right? So you can start testing, well, do our vaccines actually, can they handle, you know, these mutations that were in the past and likely will reappear, et cetera. So it's quite useful.
One of the things that characterizes modern-day Europeans is the light-skinned phenotype. When did that first emerge? How quickly did it spread? And what was it in actual? What was the adaptation? Was it vitamin D related? Was it something else?
Yeah, exactly. So it seems like it's coming. I mean, the hunter-gatherers, as far as we can see, were very dark-skinned and had these blue-gray eyes. And, you know, even when the farmers start moving up, they had lighter skin than those, right? And then you had, of course, Yamnaya, the Bronze Age Yamnaya coming in also with light skin. And you can say the general notion...
That was how long ago? Remind us.
So the farmers start moving in around 10,000 years ago, and the Yamnaya, the Bronze Age Yamnaya, it's 5,000 years ago, okay. Right? So... And you can say the general notion is that is due to vitamin D, right? That you are basically better at producing vitamin D from sunlight. And I guess there's some argument there in the sense that when you look at the skin color of Neanderthals from Europe, they also seem to have light skin, right? So it's kind of an adaptation to that. But it's something that is coming very late in our history. I mean,
less than 10,000 years.
Yeah. And for most parts, it's really within the last 5,000, right? So, so it's something which we haven't had for a very long time. No?
Yeah. So something like that, so a very morphological trait like that can spread in 5 to 10,000 years. We talked earlier about lactase persistence. That's, I mean, I think my interpretation of the lactase persistence phenotype is we're almost watching, even to this day, the spread of that. Like, it's still spreading through populations. It's only partially reached fixation. Yes. When you think about the time periods that you study, 5, 10, 20, 50,000 years ago, when you think about the rate of change that you've seen some of these selection events happen in, what does that tell you about sort of the general speed of evolution? Because I often get the impression that people think evolution is much slower than it actually is, and that, you know, we haven't been evolving for hundreds of thousands of years and things like this.
Yeah. I mean, it varies, right? I mean, I don't think you can say that there's, you know, one speed or I mean, it varies due to the selection pressure, right? I mean, so how important is it, if you want, for your survival and reproduction, right? But it can go incredibly fast. And I'll give you an example of this, right? So we did a study. I had a PhD student who did a study on the, you can say, on a group called the Banjo from Southeast Asia, which is basically a group of people who live their entire life on the ocean or in the ocean, in the water, right? So they are known as incredible free divers, right? They are basically, they can keep the, you know, can be on the water for a very long time, etc. And she wanted to investigate whether some of these adaptations were genetic, right? So not only physiological adaptations, but whether there was genetic adaptations. And the general notion is that this type of lifestyle have only existed for 1,000 years, right? And me and the other supervisor basically said to her, well, we think it's a very risky project. We don't think you will get anything out of it, because 1,000 years is way too little time for selection to act on this, right? And well, she decided she wanted to carry it out anyways. And she measured the spleen size, which is where the blood, red blood cells are stored, right? And they had like 50% larger spleen size than the ones living in the closest relative living on land. But then we saw massive selection on you know, genetic variants involved in spleen size, in the diving response. That's when you get, when we get water into our face, you know, our blood vessels will retract, our spleen will pump out, and so forth, blood, red blood cells, etc. So within 1,000 years, you know, this group had just been under massive selection pressure. And then she interviewed some of the old timers, right, of these Banjo people, and asked, you know, how can it be, you know, what, I mean, how can you have such a selection pressure? And they told her, in the old days, you know, when the baby was born, right, they basically took it through a rope underneath the boat, right, and up again. And some of them didn't survive, right? Some of them survived.
Oh, wow.
Right? And if this is true, I don't know whether it's true, but of course, if this is true, it's a massive selection, right? It's just...
There's nothing faster than that, yeah.
No, there's nothing faster than
forced
that.
Forced selection,
so,
yeah.
Exactly. So in other words, I mean, selection can happen, and not only the selection, but also the spread, if you want, the segregation of the selected variants, right? That's important to say. It's not only the selection, but also the segregation can happen incredibly fast, right, in some cases. And so I think some of the lessons, at least, that I have taken home from our work and other people's work in this area is that you know, first of all, you know, this idea of, for example, in Europe, right, that you people say, well, we are very special. In there's even people in my country making these claims, you know, we are very distinct from everybody else, and we have our own culture, and it all developed, and, you know, forget about it, right? I mean, it's a very recent history, and we all share it, you know, and things like skin color and so forth doesn't matter. I mean, I used to, before I did this type of work, you know, when I saw somebody on the street that looked different from me, I kind of thought, oh, they are very different from me. Today, I kind of, well, it's a close relative, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, it's like a cousin, right? I'm meeting a cousin here. So it's, you know, we, because of this history where we have moved around, mixed with each other, split out again, you know, brought with us cultural changes, etc. I mean, we are one big family. That's clear, and the world we live in is very recent.
How would I ask this? Like, if we looked at your genome or my genome, mm-hmm. and we compared them to each other, and then we compared them to some of those early people mm-hmm. that eventually gave rise to all Europeans from mm-hmm. you know, tens of thousands of years ago. How different would each of us be genetically?
You and I would be very similar, right? Mm-hmm. You and I would be extremely similar, most likely, because when I look at you, I mean, we're both Europeans, originating from Europe. But if you go back in time, you know, it actually changes quite substantially, right? Because if you take a hunter-gatherer, you and I would be, you know, we would have some Yamnaya in us. We would have maybe some farmer and some hunter-gatherer, right? And depending on where we are from, you know, let's say if we both are from Northwestern Europe originally, well, we would have a lot of Yamnaya, right? Less of the others. While the hunter-gatherer back then, right, have the hunter-gatherer, right? Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. So yes, I mean, all humans on Earth today is quite similar. That's the first thing I want to say, right? We are very similar, but there would be substantially more differences between me or you and one of these hunter-gatherers than there would be between the two of us.
Right? I see. That makes sense. And I'm trying to look for like an anchor point or something that we can use as an analogy. So if I think mm-hmm. about something like domestic dogs, right? So humans domesticated dogs, I don't even know how long ago that was, probably in the last tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, it's around probably, it's also hard to say, but I would say between 10 and 20, right? Something mm-hmm. like that. Right? Yeah.
So if you compare like a dog, a domesticated dog to a wolf, is that like, how does that distance compare to the people that came out of Eurasia that populated all of Europe? If we compared us to them, is it like that different? Yeah. Is it more? Is it less?
It's a really good question. I'm actually not sure in terms of you did the analysis how it would come out, but I would say that if you look at a tree, right, of European populations. If you imagine that, you know, on top of all the branches, right, you have the present day Europeans, right, how they are related to each other. And these early people coming out of Africa, entering, you can say, Europe, etc., they would fall totally basal on the chunk of the tree, right? I mean, so they would be clearly separate, right, mm-hmm. from all of us today, right? But it's because you can say we are, even within Europe, I mean, because we today are a mixture of these three migration waves that came into Europe and had, of course, similarities to each other, no doubt, I mean, genetically, but still were distinct from each other, right? They were distinct mm-hmm. from each other. They had lived in a reasonable amount of time in some degree of isolation, right? And they are then distinct. They're coming together, blending with each other in different ways. So, of course, the you can say these blended individuals that you and I are deriving from, you know, are different from each of them that are non-blended, right?
Got it. So what are you guys working on like right now? What are some of the big projects that your group is looking into? What kind of questions are you asking?
Yeah, I mean, we are still, so we still try to understand, you can say, the origins of disease risk in particularly in Europeans. And the reason why we are focusing on Europeans is you need this kind of GVAS data where you know which genetic mutations are associated with what diseases. This is, you can see, based on modern day studies, and unfortunately, this has mainly been done on European populations. So it's very difficult to you can say, do the same thing, for example, for Native Americans or Aborigine Australians or something like that. So that's one area where we are working, and also understand how this disease risk and differences in disease risk are linked to the pathogens, right? The pathogen pressures and lifestyle changes. But then we are also, I mean, we are still working with the peopling of the Americas is also an area where, you know, this is where I did a lot of my early work, and we're still doing work with different tribal communities in America. And then, you know, our new big thing, which we're putting in a lot of energy into, is to take these ancient genomes of the past, but retrieved mainly from soil, from sediment, environmental samples of the past, where you get all the plants, animals, bacteria, etc. And, you know, using, identifying which adaptations, both organismal adaptations, but also species adaptations, to climatic change, right, that you can see, and then try to reintroduce them into present-day cropping systems, because we are facing a huge food security crisis, and it's only getting worse because of climate change. It's actually a real serious problem for humanity, right? Because of climate change, we have a problem producing enough food. And it's because we have these monocultures of wheat and barley and rice, right? That we have selected for artificially, and there's very limited resilience to climatic changes. And we believe that nature carries the roadmap, you know, to how genetically adapt to these climate changes, because obviously nature has gone through this before, right? There's been many climate changes before. So if we can read that roadmap from the past and reintroduce them into some of these systems, our hope is that we can make more resilient, but also more, you can say, biodiverse cropping systems, right? So that's another area where we are putting a lot of emphasis right now.
Given given how cost-effective genome sequencing has become, it's feasible for a lot of people to get their genome sequenced. Yes. Do you have your own genome sequenced? And are we at a point where you can get your own genome and then like discover?
Well, obviously I could do it, but I'm not doing it. And it's actually a deliberate choice from my end. And it's because, you know, as you know, there's all these kind of companies, Ancestry.com and 23andMe and your name, right? Where you can put in your DNA and then you can get an analysis done, and it will say something about your ancestry. You are whatever X percent from Spain or whatever it is, or Britain. And I mean, of course you can say, I understand why people want to do this, and it's fun and interesting and all that. And it's also in some, I guess, some ways it's kind of, you can say, boosting the type of research we are doing into the past. And in fact, they're using a lot of our ancient genomes as well in their, they're downloading them and incorporating them into this. But the problem I see is that people very often use it as a means of identity, right? So you know, you hear people saying, well, you know, Uncle Bob has some Finnish ancestry. Well, that explains why he's like to drink or whatever they could say, right? And I have seen, you know, when I work with native groups, indigenous groups around the world, right, that some of these groups are also using, you know, either genetics or blood quantum, for example, which is just another way of doing this, to kind of say who could be a member or not a member of a community, right? And in my, so it's again, you know, this about identity. But for me personally, identity is who you believe you are, right? It's not nothing to do with your DNA record. It's you know, if you are born, let's say, born and raised on a reservation somewhere in the US, right? And you believe, well, I've been born and raised and I believe I am, you know, a part of this community, right? And then somebody comes and demands for a DNA test and then they find out, well, you're not really part of this community, right? Is this, you know, what is identity? Identity is how you are raised, how you are, who you believe you are, what community you are, have been part of. So therefore, I just feel that it's the wrong way of using this type of data, personally.
What if you wanted to use it, like, are we at a point where you could use it to, you know, we talked a lot about the different physiological and metabolic adaptations that different lineages have. Could you use it to help understand things like your metabolic disease risk or make decisions around what to eat?
Yeah. I think so, and it will be increasingly so, right? I mean, it's still, I think, a challenge to use this type of data for most cases, not all, but for many cases on an individual base, right? It's on a population base, right, where you have a group of people and you say, yes, as a group of people, you know, the one with more Yamnaya has a higher chance of multiple sclerosis, etc. That works. But for a single individual, in some cases, yes, it works. You know, there's certain cancer genes and so forth. But in many cases, it's actually, you can say, the predictive value on the individual level is actually not as good, right, as on the population level. So it can be a bit dangerous to do it. But yes, I believe this is the direction things are going. And of course, as you can say, we understand more and more about, you can say, what the functions of the genome. I think this will increasingly be the case, and people will have to also determine with themselves, right? Do you want to know or do you not want to know, right? Because that's the next question, right? I mean, you get some kind of probability, right? It's not like you're told, well, you will get diabetes or you will get this type of cancer or whatever. It's all a probability. And do you want to live with that and try to live accordingly to avoid it, but also bearing the burden of going around being nervous about getting something right you might get or you might not get? Or will you rather, as we have done for the last 600,000 years, going around and then see what's coming, right? And I guess it depends on personality and so forth. But yes, I think we are going in this direction. And also, if you take I think that a place where it can also help maybe is to destigmatize some of these things, right? If you take the multiple sclerosis, for example, as I said to you earlier, right, the reason why you and I are here are most likely because there was some of our ancestors that were carrying these mutations, right? And yes, there's some people who today are suffering, if you want, because the lifestyle is not the same, right? And we should be thankful for these mutation was around, right? So it's another way to look at it than simply just
those diseases are in some sense an echo of a previous adaptation.
Exactly, right. And it gives us also a deeper understanding, I think, of the diseases, right? So it's not just something that is just coming around, for example, right? It's actually have a deep evolutionary roots, right? It's not something that you easily can just remove, but rather maybe you should start thinking of the disease in a different manner, maybe, right? Where you are thinking about, well, it's all about getting the right balance between the immune system. It's not about just hammering it down, right? To it, but it's about the balance, etc. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not trying to make claims here about how it can treat stuff, people. But my basic standing is that the more we know about the underlying reason for any disease, right, and disease risk, I think we are in a better position to understand it and therefore also treat it and deal with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the disease risk stuff that you've worked on, it sounds like sort of a general pattern was people started living in denser populations, both yes. other human beings and animals that they domesticated. Obviously, that facilitated the evolution of new infectious diseases and the spread of those diseases through these larger populations. And in essence, some of our susceptibility to certain types of disease, like autoimmune disease, we could sort of think of it as the immune system became more hyperactive in certain ways exactly. to deal with the higher density of infectious yeah. agents that were circulating. And a side effect of that in the present day is that in the absence, because we're cleaner now, we have more medicines, yeah. we have better hygiene, those hyperactive immune systems, so to speak, they don't need to be hyperactive anymore. And then a side effect of that is something like MS or psoriasis or whatever.
Exactly.
When we think about it in that way, and we put it in evolutionary context, what do you think about things like the so-called hygiene hypothesis?
Yeah.
And
no, I think it makes sense. Yeah. I think the hygiene hypothesis is this about, you know, many of the troubles we're dealing with in terms of autoimmune diseases, et cetera, is simply because we have become too clean, if you want, right? And I think the take-home message here, which I think is important, is when we're talking about many of these, you can say, variants that in a certain environment are creating some problems for us, right? In other environments, they are actually beneficial, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like where you're just saying, oh, this is bad, right? Or this is good, right? It all depends on the context, right? The same goes for, you know, the thing we talked about with the fats rich and all that, right? With, the change in food, right? So if you can say, if the hunter-gatherer was winning, or you're living as a hunter-gatherer, right? I mean, you and I that probably have some of these adaptations to high carbohydrate food, right? Well, it would be nothing, right? It would not be worth anything in such an environment, right? It's only worth something because we're actually living in a high carbohydrate, the type of diet we're eating today, right, in our society. So in other words, it all depends on the context, right? It depends on where you are. And we are all, you can say, we are all a result of, you can say, our ancestral history, where something at some point in time and place were actually beneficial in the past, right? And today maybe it might be beneficial or it might not be beneficial, right? But we all have this with us. We all carrying that ancestry and legacy of our ancestors. And I would say if there's anything, to me, it has kind of made me rethink, if you want, as an individual and as a human being, is I don't know how it is in America, but I always learned in school, or were told in school and at home, by the way, that you need to adapt, right? You need to adapt to, now you are going to school, you need to adapt and do what they say, and you need to adapt to this, and you need to adapt to that, and so forth. But in reality, I think we should look at it differently, right? We all have this, we're all carrying this, you can say, genetic legacy with us. And it varies from one person to the next and from one population to the next. And it's really about finding the environment, in my view, that fits your genetic record, right? So you should go out and try to find out, you know, what is fitting me, right? This, what I'm carrying with me of good or bad or whatever, some is good in the environment I am now, some is not so good. Maybe this environment is not the right for me. Maybe I should go somewhere else where I'm better suited, right? So.
Well, this has been fascinating. I learned a lot, and we only had time to cover one chunk of human history. There's many other places we could have gone in time and in geography. You've done a lot of interesting work about Native Americans and the original humans to come into the Americas. So at some point, I would love to talk about that as well. But do you have any final thoughts or things you want to reiterate for people before we sign off?
I think we have covered a lot of ground still, but you're right. I mean, we could continue. We have done a lot of work in Australia, a lot in America, a lot in Southeast Asia, a lot in Central Asia that we haven't really covered here. So, well, if you want, we can just make another session at some point and cover some of the other parts.
Yeah, I would love that.
For your audience, you are US-based, right? I guess the peopling of the Americas would probably be something that some of your audience would find fascinating, I assume. But
yeah, absolutely. And I still have to read some of those papers, so I don't know the details yet.
Yeah.
But thank you for your time. This was fascinating, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.